From the Blue Ridge Mountains to the Chesapeake Bay, Virginia is a mecca for outdoor travel and adventure. Virginia Outdoor Adventures podcast is the ultimate guide for local outdoor recreation, including hiking, camping, kayaking, and so much more. Get the information and the inspiration to plan your own adventure right here in Virginia. I'm your host, Jessica Bowser. Imagine taking a peek at aquatic life below the surface of the James River, or watching peregrine falcons hatch atop a Richmond skyscraper. The Virginia Department of Wildlife Resources live streaming cameras offer a glimpse into the wonderful world of Virginia's wildlife, from restored elk habitat in the mountains to the tidal marshes of the coast. Megan Thomas, watchable wildlife biologist, describes what makes these wildlife camps so popular, how you can contribute as a community scientist, and why you won't want to miss a moment of eggs hatching, fish migrating, elk bugling, and so much more. Let's go. Virginia Outdoor Adventures is sponsored by the Virginia Department of Wildlife Resources. DWR is your conservation agency to connect you to outdoor recreation opportunities, manage wildlife, and protect you while you enjoy the outdoors. The outdoors are better together when we restore, explore, and protect. Learn more by clicking Virginia Department of Wildlife Resources in your show notes. This podcast is also sponsored by Breaks Interstate Park. Breathtaking views, towering cliffs, roaring rivers, unlimited adventure. Discover the rugged beauty of Breaks Park, home of the Grand Canyon of the South. From rock climbing to mountain biking, elk tours to canyon rim ziplining, your adventure awaits at the Breaks. Book your 2023 elk tour today. Click on Breaks Interstate Park in your show notes to visit breakspark.com. Blue Ridge Outdoors Magazine takes readers deep into the mountains, covering adventure, recreation, travel, and culture. The largest free, independent outdoor lifestyle magazine in the country, Blue Ridge Outdoors is dedicated to inspiring people in the Blue Ridge and beyond to go outside and play. Every issue includes coverage of top scenic destinations, multi-sport spotlights, interviews with inspiring adventurers, new gear reviews, and features on regional music and culture. Check out Blue Ridge Outdoors Magazine on newsstands monthly or click the link in your show notes to visit BlueRidgeOutdoors.com. Megan, welcome to Virginia Outdoor Adventures.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
What do you love about Virginia's outdoors?
I grew up in Maryland. I spent a lot of time on the Chesapeake Bay. And I think despite living in like all over, you know, North America, the Chesapeake Bay has remained one of my absolutely favorite places in the country. So I've got to say our tidal marshes, I think, out that way.
Yeah, tidal marshes. And we're going to be talking about that in this episode. But before we do, could you describe DWR's wildlife cam program?
So DWR, we have a variety of different live streaming wildlife viewing cameras that folks can tune into throughout the year, basically that give you the opportunity to see a little bit about different wildlife species that we've got in the Commonwealth, no matter where you're located, right? So like whether you're at the office, you're at your home, even if you're out of the country, you could check in on one of these cameras if they're live at the time and see if there's anything going on. So we've got the Falcon Cam, which is in downtown Richmond is where that's located. It's pointed at a peregrine falcon nest box. And then we've got a Shad Cam, which is also in the Richmond area, although this one actually gives you a look under the surface of the James River. We have a Marsh Cam, which is brand new. That is located in Surrey, Virginia, on one of our wildlife management areas. And then out in Southwest Virginia, where the elk restoration happened, we actually have an elk cam as well. So from coast to mountains, there's something that you can see at any given time during the year.
Yeah, I've been watching these cams for a while now. I really love Falcon Cam and I love Elk Cam. And just recently I started watching Marsh Cam because that just launched for the year. So I'm really excited about all of these cams. It's for me, this sort of gives me like an opportunity in the middle of the day when I can't get outside to just have that meditative connection or zen to the outdoors. Like I just have the cams open on my desktop and I'll click back to them every now and then in between the work that I'm doing just to see what's going on or if there's anything new or exciting there. And when there is, it's just super exciting, right? It's like, oh my gosh, look at this. And sometimes it's something that you would expect to see and sometimes it's not. So it's just a really neat respite in the middle of the day to be able to check in on what's going on around Virginia.
Yes, for sure. I noticed that you didn't say shad cam there. That one is going to be going live for the season here in March. So I'm excited for you to hopefully start tuning into Shad Cam as well.
Yeah, that's the one I haven't seen yet. So I'm also excited about it. Is there one that's more popular than others?
You know, I would say our Falcon Cam is probably the most popular right now, although the Elk camera has been getting, we see more and more viewers on Elk Cam every year. So it's getting kind of neck and neck almost between Elk and Falcon Cam. But Falcon Cam is probably the most popular. We have close to 500,000 views each year on the Falcon Cam.
So when I learned how many hits or how many views the DWR website gets on Falcon Cam, I was seriously blown away. I mean, it's an incredible number. And clearly this is really, really popular.
It actually has just recently, so like the last couple of years, it has been making it into the top 10 most viewed DWR pages, like annually.
Yeah. And what makes Falcon Cam so popular?
You know, I hate to say this, but there's some drama that's baked into the Falcon Cam, right? And like, as much as you want to say that you don't love the drama, I feel like the drama is what gets the views. You get attached to these birds that you see on camera. So, you know, the season starts in early March. So that's typically right around the time that if there's a current pair there that they're going through some of this pair bonding stuff, you might even see courtship on camera. And then you get to watch this pair of birds as they maintain a nest box and they go on to produce a clutch of eggs that they incubate. And then you hope the eggs hatch. And then if they do hatch, you get to watch them as they raise these chicks. And then ultimately, you know, up to when the chicks fledge, you get this like really intimate view at something that you don't get to see too often. And you kind of get to know the birds and what to expect from them. Just different behaviors, you know, all of that sort of stuff, you get sucked in. It's like nature documentaries or Natural Geographic. You know, I think it's kind of that same appeal that those things have. You get that here and you get it in downtown Richmond, which is probably like the last place people expect to have something like that going on. But you do.
It's neat. Are you allowed to tell us where this nest is in Richmond?
Yeah, so it is on the 21st story of the Riverfront Plaza buildings, more specifically the West Tower. So it's really close to the James River, if you were to look at a map. But yeah, it's like a skyscraper in the center of downtown Richmond.
There's a really cool video on DWR's website, and I'll put a link to it in the show notes that actually shows the building and then the exterior of the building where the nest is. It's a really interesting documentary about you and one of your colleagues and the process of monitoring Falcon Cam or monitoring the falcons with Falcon Cam. And it's really cool to see you all strapped in to all these harnesses and going out onto the ledge when it's necessary and where the cameras are installed, what the birds have been eating, like the leftover bird parts from their meals, the chicks, what, you know, once they had, do you attach the bird bands on the chicks?
I actually have not done that yet, although my hope is that this year is going to be my first year where I am actually doing the banding and not just the capturing or the holding of chicks while other folks band.
That would be exciting. It's just hilarious to watch you guys holding the chicks to do the banding process because they're like these mini dinosaurs, but they're not that small. Like you think about a bird chick, you think of something tiny. These peregrine falcon chicks are huge. It's like holding a big stuffed animal.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, at the age that we band them, their legs are fully developed, right? So their legs are the size that they are as a fully grown adult, right? Because you can't put a band on a bird and then have its leg get bigger. So yeah, I mean, even though they're still mostly like white and fluffy, they're pretty big. They're the size of an adult.
So what is the history of peregrine falcons in Virginia?
The biggest, most notable event, I think, in peregrine falcon history happened right around the end of World War II when people started using those pesticides like DDT. I think most people are familiar with Rachel Carson and Silent Spring, where she kind of talked about this stuff. But basically, all of those pesticides getting sprayed on the environment, it caused basically like a bioaccumulation of these toxic components in prey species that, you know, accumulated within falcons, and it would cause the eggshells of the falcons to become really, really fragile. Right around like the mid 1960s time, we actually were at this period where, as far as we know, there were not any breeding pairs of peregrine falcons, not just in Virginia, but like totally east of the Mississippi. Because the years leading up to it, there had been really no successful, there had been no offspring that had been raised. You know, a lot of the eggs were so fragile that they were either broken when they were getting laid or during like incubation exchanges, stuff like that. So there was just no recruitment into the adult population. And then ultimately, you know, the species was listed as endangered in 1970 by Fish and Wildlife Service. So then after that happened around the late 1970s, there was a really, really big push by a lot of different groups, basically to restore eastern peregrine populations, not even just in Virginia, but again, like totally east of the Mississippi. Basically, they had worked with some folks at Cornell who were actually able to captive rear peregrines. And then they started working with different states and universities to release those captive peregrines all across the eastern U.S., including Virginia. Between like 1978 and the early 1990s, we actually had about 250 falcons released in Virginia in the hopes that they would ultimately like go on and start coming back and nesting on their own, and that we wouldn't need to continue to rely on these captive reared populations. And then right around, gosh, I think it was 1982, I want to say. I know it was on Assateague Island, but I'm pretty sure 1982 was actually our first wild peregrine nest that we had, which was really, really exciting because, again, you know, they were totally extinct east of the Mississippi by like the 70s for sure. So that was our first wild nest in the state for many years. And then since then, you know, the population has been slowly getting larger, like year after year, but there's still a lot of reintroducing that goes on today. We actually, it's through a process we call hacking. So yeah, you take like young falcons, basically around the time that they're like 28 to 30 days old. It's actually right around the same time that they get banded. So you can take them at that point. They're not able to fly quite yet. And then you can relocate them to a different area. And you basically like put them in a really big box and you continue to provide them with food, but you really minimize any type of human interaction. And then about like 10 days or so later, when they are able to fly, the box is opened and then the birds are released. And generally they'll stay around that same area, you know, for at least a couple of weeks. And they'll continue to have food put out for them, but they're not contained in the box or anything like that anymore. That's like a quick lowdown on how you reintroduce a falcon, but that's about where we're at now with falcons. You know, we've been doing these hacking efforts, you know, like ever since the early 80s.
Wow. So this has been going on for a while. Do you know what the current population of falcons is in Virginia?
At this point in time, there are give or take roughly 30 pairs that breed or so every year here in Virginia. Most of them are actually breeding on the coast, which was where our early hacking efforts were. We do get a handful of pairs in the mountains that breed every year, but by and large, the majority are on the coast. So, you know, even though there is this like slow but steady kind of increase that we've documented over the past couple of years, or past couple of decades, I should say, the population, it's still not totally self-sustaining yet. So like our goals are really to ensure that the coastal nesting falcons kind of see continued nesting success, but we also really want to make sure that we're able to continue our efforts towards recovery of those mountain breeding populations. And because of that, they're, even though they're not federally listed anymore, peregrine falcons in Virginia are still state threatened.
I mean, I'm not any sort of an expert, but 30 breeding pairs doesn't sound like a lot across this big state.
No, it's not. Although, but I do want to just note too, you know, even prior to the whole DDT thing, like after World War II and all of that, it's not like falcons were super, super prolific, right? Like, it's not like we had thousands of breeding pairs across the state, at least from what we know that's kind of reported historically. In fact, I want to say it was like around in 1940s, I want to say it was like there was an estimated 350 pairs east of the Mississippi entirely. So,
yeah. So there really weren't that many. I mean, what I know about peregrine falcons is that they're pretty widespread. They're on 6 continents, I'm pretty sure. But even though they are all across the globe, there's not a lot of them. It's still a low number.
That's exactly right. You know, and again, I mean, our coastal population is doing great. So maintaining stability there is key, but where we're really wanting to focus our efforts now and where we have been in, you know, the past 10 years or so is really trying to make sure that we get those mountain populations back up, because that's actually like where the majority of peregrines were breeding historically. There were a handful of nests that would happen in the coastal plain of Virginia, but by and large, they were a species that was breeding and nesting primarily in these mountain habitats. So it's a little bit ironic that, you know, now we don't have too many of them in the mountains. The majority are on the coastal plain.
Want to help keep the wild places wild? The Virginia Department of Wildlife Resources invites you to join in its mission to ensure wildlife has healthy places to live and thrive by becoming a Restore the Wild member. Habitat loss and degradation threaten nearly all of Virginia's wildlife, from elk to turtles to even our smallest pollinators. 100% of your membership dollars will support habitat projects vital for the survival of Virginia's wildlife. Plus, you'll gain access to wildlife management areas across Virginia that are ideal for your next adventure. The outdoors are better together, so join today. Click on Restore the Wild membership in the show notes of your listening app. Can you tell us about the current breeding pair that's on the falcon cam?
So they both, in my mind, have like a little bit of a story. So our current female is 95 AK. So I don't want to say it's like a name, but that 95 AK, that's the code that is on one of her leg bands, more specifically what we call the field readable leg band. So her unique code is 95 AK, and there's no other falcon out there that has that exact code. So if she ever was to get sighted somewhere else and somebody saw that 95 AK, they could use that information basically to identify her. She is our current female, and she has actually been in the Richmond area since 2019. But she actually was hatched and raised in Delaware on a bridge nest. When she first showed up on camera in 2019, she actually, she didn't even have like her full adult plumage or anything yet. She was still pretty young, and she was on camera with our former male that whole season. She didn't end up producing any eggs that year. But the next year, her and the former male did go on to produce a clutch of 4 eggs, one of which hatched. So that was her first ever chick. That was in 2020. And then we have had her on camera ever since. I think one of the things that I really like the most about her is that that year in 2020, that she did have that first chick, there was another female, an unbanded female, that had been seen on camera interacting with the former male for close to a month at that point. And then 95 AK our current female, we got footage of her basically like engaging in a territorial dispute with the male and the female. And that went on for several hours, and we weren't sure, you know, what the outcome was going to be. But ultimately she ended up ousting that unbanded female and claiming her territory, so to speak. And she's been there ever since. So I just like love that feistiness to her. And then our current male, he's 59 BM. So same concept with the field readable bands. He's got the 59 in the black part of the band, and then BM is in the green part. He was actually hatched in Yorktown. So he's a Virginia native. He was hatched at a nest box in Yorktown atop a power station. And ironically enough, the female falcon that hatched him and raised him, she actually was seen on camera in 2017. She was our breeding female in 2017. She only bred there for 1 year before she ultimately like moved on to Yorktown, where she's been breeding ever since. But that's where our current male was hatched. And he has been on camera now for basically since 2021. So there was another male before him who had bred with 95 AK that 2020 year, who unfortunately is now deceased. But yeah, 59 BM. He's been around for a couple of years now. So this will be his third year with chicks, his third year, and 95 AK's fourth year, assuming all goes well.
You were telling me earlier this funny story. Was it the current male or the previous male who during his first clutch looked really confused on the day yes. that the eggs finally hatched? Tell me that story.
Yeah. And it's, you know, as a biologist, I have to say, like, we're it's really ingrained in us when we're trained, you know, not to do any type of like anthropomorphizing or anything like that. But this male on his very first clutch ever, I will never forget going back and reviewing the footage. And it was right after the first egg had hatched, and he was coming in for what we call an incubation exchange, which is basically just where the male and the female, they switch places atop the eggs, right? So he was coming in for an incubation exchange. Little did he know that one of the eggs had hatched underneath the female while he was away from the nest box. And so just having it on footage when he comes into the nest box, and you can see him just very slowly kind of approaching where the eggs are. And there's this one new little chick that's moving around and vocalizing and all of that. And I have like no other words to describe, you know, his behavior as just like utterly bewildered, right? Like, again, this is totally anthropomorphizing, but in my mind, it was like he left and there were these eggs that he was sitting on, and he came back and there's this new thing that's not an egg anymore. And he didn't quite know what to do. So it was like getting to watch that kind of natural instinct take over as he was, you know, becoming like a first time parent and had to care for these chicks for the first time. That was really, really fun to watch. And it was even more fun to watch in his second year with chicks when I got to see how, you know, like at this point he had been through it all one time before. So, you know, whereas like in the beginning with that first clutch, he maybe feeding was a little bit more difficult. You know, you've got to get the little teeny tiny torn off parts of meat like directly in these little chick mouths. And so watching him that second year, like he didn't struggle with feeding them anywhere near to the degree that he did in that first day or so with those first time chicks. So he's definitely come a long way as a parent. But yes, that was very fun to be able to get that on camera and see that reaction of his.
Oh, that's so cute. No wonder people are addicted to this cam.
Yes. Yes. It's hard not to be. It's hard not to be. I mean, I even myself, you know, at my house, we have a TV in my home that is dedicated entirely to the Falcon Cam. So like every season on Falcon Cam, day and night, weekend, weeknight, you know, work hours or not, the Falcon Cam is playing on a dedicated TV in our home. My husband just knows to expect that.
What challenges are the current Falcons experiencing?
So for the current pair, I would say that the challenges that they're up against aren't really unique to like the Richmond pair. It's really just anything that any of these urban nesting falcons go through, right? Because this isn't the only pair that breeds in a like on top of a skyscraper, a really tall building in a highly populated urban metropolis. Ultimately, I think it's the most challenging for the fledgling. So the chicks, like right once they leave that nest box, they're fledged, right? That's what we say. So then they kind of become, they become fledglings. And so learning how to fly and even more specifically, learning how to land in these areas can be pretty dangerous for them. So, you know, on the one hand, getting like there's a higher chance of them actually getting grounded, which if it was to happen in a less urban area wouldn't necessarily be that big of a deal. But in a city, you know, if you get grounded, you know, it's very likely that you'll wind up on the street, right? So that's a possibility. But then the other thing that we have kind of documented that the fledglings struggle with a little bit is really calculating or navigating landing and not coming in too hard for a land or not hard enough and then just kind of like skittering down the building, basically. So we unfortunately have had some instances in previous years where fledglings have actually hit buildings and died, unfortunately. So I would say that is the most difficult thing for them in this particular environment. It's really those fledglings. And that's a big part too of why we put that pen up after we banned the bird. So if you've watched Falcon Camp before, you know that after they get banded, they get put into this pen that's attached to the nest box. And that's to prevent them from fledging before they're ready, which is another thing that we have had happen before. So it really ensures that by the time they do leave that nest box, they're developed enough that they shouldn't have too many issues flying once they figure out like the mechanics behind it, basically.
It makes my heart go out to the little babies because full grown peregrine adults are incredibly impressive flyers. I mean, they can dive over 100 miles per hour. Isn't that right?
Over 200 miles per hour.
They're 200.
They're the fastest animal in the world, technically. That's primarily how they hunt. They hunt other birds and they dive bomb other birds. They basically fly above other birds and dive bomb them. And they can hit them at over 200 miles per hour. So basically like killing their prey on impact.
They're incredibly impressive birds of prey, but they all have to start somewhere. They all have to learn, right?
Yes, very much so. And you know, so you just made me think of just something else too that I don't know, maybe viewers would find this fun. I know I certainly do, but those fledglings, even after they fledge the nest box and that nest area, the adults will go on and still take care of them for weeks following fledgling. And they'll actually kind of help them hone those hunting skills. So we've seen it before where they do these aerial prey exchanges, right? Where like the adults will come in with a prey item and they try to tempt the young birds into the air. And they'll do this like aerial exchange of a food item. Or in some cases, the adults will even drop the food item and it will encourage the young falcons to kind of protect or perfect that like dive bombing, you know, to catch the dropped prey item in midair. It's absolutely amazing if you ever get the chance to watch it.
Wow, how cool. So you've been observing these birds for years. You've gotten to know them pretty well. Do you have any hopes and dreams for the falcons that you've been observing in Richmond?
I would say, gosh, I just love that question. I think that for me, my biggest hopes and dreams for the current pair is that they have a long, long life ahead of them breeding at that Richmond site. The pair before them, I want to say they had like a run of like 15 years together that where they were nesting in downtown Richmond. And so if these two went on to produce eggs every year for the next 15 years, I would be absolutely amazed. I would just love that. And then likewise, you know, I think the thing that I really love the most is when I find out that one of the chicks that appeared on camera in a certain year was spotted somewhere else. It doesn't happen too often because again, these are birds that are really high up in the air, right? So to get a look at those bands that I was talking about, you need some pretty advanced equipment like spotting scopes or a camera with a really, 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 really high powered Zoom. But every once in a while, we do get these reports, and we kind of get to hear about a bird that, you know, we last saw it as a chick on camera. And we find out that it's now set up and it's the breeding peregrine at some other city or state or whatnot. And in fact, the most recent example of this happening, I want to say it was 2021, the red male falcon. And I say red, I realized we hadn't talked about that yet, but I say red because after we band them, we actually put some colored tape on the bands that just falls off naturally. And that kind of helps us identify them after they have fledged. But so the male that got the red tape, he is now in the Virginia Beach area where he has been seen bonding with a female. And I'm really, really hopeful that those two are going to go on and produce a nest this year. That would just make me absolutely, oh my gosh, so happy, right? One of the, just knowing that one of those chicks that was on camera is now not only returned to Virginia, but is, you know, raising chicks of his own. That would be so cool.
Let's talk also about some of these other cams. I mean, we've focused so much on Falcon Cam, which is super popular. But I want to hear about Shad Cam as well and some of the others.
Shad Cam is actually, you know, as much as I love the Falcons, right? Shad Cam, like if I was just a viewer, I feel like Shad Cam would be my favorite cam because I it's so different, right? It's also located in the general Richmond area. It's installed at Boshier's Dam on the James River. So it is associated with a fishway that they have there. And if you don't know what a fishway is, it's basically this installation that's constructed along the dam that allows migratory fish to pass over the dam and continue on their journey to their spawning ground. So like if the fishway wasn't in place, those species would have no way to access, you know, the upper area of the James River above where that dam is. And part of the fishway, it involves a counting room, which is actually like underground that you have to climb down a ladder to get into it. But it's underground and it's what we call the fish counting room. And there's a big, big window there that provides you with a look into the fishway, right? So you look at you look into this window and it's kind of like looking at the glass in the aquarium. What you're looking at is like totally underwater. And that's what the Shad Cam is focused on. So it basically gives you a look at fish as they're swimming through that last section of the fishway and right as they're about to re-enter the James River above the dam.
Cool. I mean, I saw a picture of it and it sort of reminds me of a submarine, like you're going down under the water and looking at what's all around you under the water. It's pretty neat.
Yes, it does. It does.
So why is river connectivity so important to migratory fishes? I mean, I don't think I knew that some fish migrate, but this is a topic that I'm somewhat unfamiliar with. Can you explain that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I feel like a decent amount of people know about fish and migration, but definitely not too many. You know, I feel like anytime I give a presentation on the Shad Cam or something like that, I always get this question. Like, people are so fascinated about fish migration, right? Like, we all know that birds migrate, but not too many people know about fish migration. And not all fish migrate, obviously. Like, we have quite a few resident species, but we also have some migratory fish here in Virginia as well, both anadromous, which is like what the shad are. So that basically means that they migrate from saltwater to freshwater to breed. And then we've got catadromous, like our American eel, which is the opposite, where they spend most of their lives in freshwater. And then when it comes time to breed, they actually migrate to saltwater where they spawn. So we have both and both of which are found in the James River. But anyways, in answer to your question about river connectivity. Yeah. So, these fish, you know, they spawn in these very, very specific water conditions. And for a lot of fish species, the larva needs specific water conditions as well. And so, you know, in like colonial times, none of our rivers were dammed, right? Or there were none of these barriers that prevented fish from going all the way from, you know, like the entrance of the Chesapeake Bay all the way through the many tributaries of the James River. And in fact, you know, American shad, historically, they were spawning, they were entering into the James River, and then there's reports of them spawning even as far upwards as like the Lynchburg area, right? But once you start damming waterways, that becomes impossible. So it's basically like a major, major portion of their spawning grounds are cut off. And so that's why that ability for them to pass somehow, either through things like dam removal or construction of these fishways, is so, so important, especially for species like American shad, which have had dwindling populations as of late. You know, getting them as much access to these spawning grounds as we can is so, so important to the survival of those species.
So if somebody's watching Shad Cam, what are they going to be seeing other than shad? Is there something else that they can see? Will they know what they're seeing?
Yeah, there is so much else to be seen on Shad Cam. And I think that this is why I say that this might be my absolute favorite of our cams, just from like a viewer perspective. You do see a lot of gizzard shad. And if you're very lucky, you get to see one of those elusive American shad, which, as I indicated earlier, their populations are in decline. But in addition to those two species, you know, you can see tons and tons of other fish, many of which people just don't even know we have in the James River. So like sea lampreys are one of my absolute favorite ones. And if you really want to see a sea lamprey, your best time is at night, actually at like 3 a.m. in the morning. So if you struggle with insomnia or you're awake at 3 a.m. in the morning when the shad cam's rolling, I would really encourage you to pull up the shad cam, because it's just so fascinating to watch these. Like, everybody thinks that they're eels, but they're not, but they just are like squiggling all around the window. I would encourage you to look at what a sea lamprey looks like. It's very difficult for me to try to come up with the words to describe them, but they're just absolutely fascinating looking creatures. And so then, like, in addition to sea lamprey, you know, you can get things like quillback and huge carp and blue cats and flathead catfish and channel catfish. We've seen sunfish, we've seen gar, you know, we've seen some of the smaller minnow species. We've seen northern hog suckers. We've even seen like a rainbow trout. In there's, I want to say to date, we've had like something like over 25 different species that have been documented on Shad Cam. And some of them are really, really big. We actually have a board at the window in front of Shad Cam, where there's lines that are marked every 6 inches. So, if you're watching, you can kind of use that board with those tick marks to get an estimate of how big the fish are that you're seeing pass through the window.
Oh, that's cool. And how do you see them at night? Isn't it too dark?
So we actually have lights that are on in the fish counting room that do enable you to see the fish as they're moving through at night.
Did you know that you can become a member of Virginia Outdoor Adventures? For the same price as a cup of coffee once a month, you can receive a Virginia Outdoor Adventures membership while supporting the show. Members have access to the complete list of links and resources from each episode. Members also receive Virginia Outdoor Adventures vinyl stickers and a shout out on the show. If you're enjoying this podcast, please consider supporting me. Hit pause on your podcast player, go to your show notes, and click on Buy Me a Coffee, where you can buy me a virtual coffee or sign up for a membership. My sincere gratitude for the newest members of Virginia Outdoor Adventures: Kimberly from Arlington, Ron from Bowling Green, Musa from Fairfax, Lori from Hopewell, Kevin from Yorktown, and Jennifer from Falls Church. Thank you so much for your support. What kind of data are you collecting from Shad Cam?
Yeah, so some of the most important information that we get does come back to the American shad and trying to get estimates of the number of American shad that pass through that fishway each year. But basically, you know, our fisheries biologists, they are reviewing multiple segments, like randomized 15-minute segments from every single day that the shad cam is on, and they are making note of not just every single species that's passing by, but how many are passing by in that 15-minute increment of video footage as well. So if you have watched Shad Cam and you've seen these instances where you get these large pulses of gizzard shad pushed through, it is not uncommon to see like 100 gizzard shad move through the fishway in a period of, you know, 60 seconds. So they're counting all of that. And then they use all of that data to be able to get an estimate or extrapolate basically the number of each species that pass through the fishway.
So we've got Falcon Cam, we've got Shad Cam. What about Marsh Cam? This is one of the newer cams. So tell me about that.
This one is very different than the other two. For one thing, it is totally remote, other than like, as you know, as opposed to the other two. So Marsh Cam is totally solar powered, and the internet is actually beamed like something like 3 miles from a hardwired internet connection. Then it's like beamed across the James River to where the Marsh Cam is located on one of our WMAs in Surrey County, Hog Island WMA. And so unlike the other cameras where they're really focused on like a particular species, or in the case of the Shad Cam, you know, it's at least focused on fish in general. The Marsh Cam is our first camera that is really more broadly just like ecosystem focused. So it is like it's got the ability to do what we call pan tilt zoom, of a 360 degree radius. So depending on whoever, like wherever the operator wants to point it at, they have a 360 degree view field around the camera. And within that view field, we've got one of the tidal marshes of the James River. And then we've got two of our managed wetland impoundments, which are particularly attractive to different species of waterfowl and shorebirds at varying times of the year. So this one, like I said, it's not focused so much on a single species. It's very like overall ecosystem focused, and it's on day and night too. So you can see raccoons at night. You can see raccoons in the day too, but, you know, there's lots of different stuff that you can see out there. And, I think one of the things that I'm the most excited about with that one is the fact that this is a camera that we built with the idea that we really wanted a way to get these habitats, and this diversity into schools across the state. So we really built it with educators in mind, and kind of came up with this way that if you're an educator, you can actually sign out the camera for the day or even for the week. And you can have your students control the Marsh Cam, so they can move it around the marsh and zoom in at the different, you know, plants or wildlife that may be on camera at the time. And our education coordinator, her and I have worked on some fabulous resources, like curriculum that can be incorporated, like lesson plans directly into the classroom. So that I think is really, really cool. You know, that like, if you're a student in a classroom, your class could actually like sign it out for the day and control it. That's not something we have with any of our other cameras, really.
Oh my gosh. As a former teacher, I love this. Like, I wish this was around when I was teaching, because I would have just had it on all the time. Like, no matter what else was going on in the classroom, just leave it on and let the kids observe. And also, it's like I said in the beginning, it's that calming effect, right? So like, yeah. I'm just imagining how many kids are going to benefit from the calming effect of the connection to nature, to have it there all day long.
If you are an educator, I would definitely encourage you to sign up, or at least check it out and see if it's something you think your students would like.
Oh yeah. I'll be sharing this with all my teacher friends, I promise. Is there something else that makes this camera so unique?
I mean, one of the things that, you know, another thing that's nice with this camera is that we actually have volunteer operators. So like our CWF volunteers, or conservation workforce volunteers, they are the ones who are doing most of the operating, you know, to make sure that the camera is that it's pointed at something to see if there is something in that 360 degree radius. And we also have an iNaturalist project where those volunteers or even just casual observers, they can take screenshots and share their observations to that iNaturalist project. And that kind of creates this really nice collection of all these different photos that other people can see. So I can tell you, like, off the top of my head, I know there were recent photos that came in from one of our volunteers that had he had gotten some really great photos of some mink. Actually,
oh,
there's
no
like
kidding.
Three mink that are running across one of the roads. And then that same volunteer, a couple of nights prior to that, he had captured a bobcat in that same area.
Oh, wow.
I know, just such cool observations you can get. And then as far as birds are concerned, Hog Island is one of the few places where you can pretty regularly see white pelicans, not brown pelicans, but white pelicans, which is a different species. You can see them pretty regularly in the area, and they make periodic appearances on camera. So if you haven't ever seen a white pelican or you don't live close to Hog Island, this camera is a good opportunity to give you a look at white pelicans too.
Oh, that's really tempting. I want to get on there right now and see what's going on right this minute, because I've never seen mink in the wild. You know, they're very elusive. Mm-hmm. I've heard of other people seeing them. I have not. Still haven't seen a bob. Oh, no, I did see a bobcat once many, many years ago, but haven't seen one in probably a decade. So I would love to see that again. When I was looking at Marsh Cam the last time, I was watching, there was a flock of, oh gosh, I can't remember what it was, maybe coots, land. And then of course you've got your regulars, like your great blue herons and your gulls and things like that. But gosh, I would love to see a bobcat or a mink or just something that you're not expecting, right? Like that would be so exciting.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even me as a wildlife biologist, I have seen mink in the wild, but fewer than 5 times. And I think the same could be said about the bobcats. Yeah.
Tell me more about how to log observations, because I love iNaturalist. That app is wonderful. And I'd love to be able to participate as a community scientist. So how do people log those observations?
Yeah. So this first step would be to get yourself an iNaturalist account if you don't already have one. You can sign up for free. And then you would join our project that we've created on iNaturalist, which is called the DWR Marsh Cam Project. And you can find instructions for all of this on that Marsh Cam website as well. But once you join the project, you can start uploading photos. So we're asking folks, you know, as they're watching, to take screenshots of things that they see on camera and then upload those screenshots to that iNaturalist project. So we can keep track of the different species that people are seeing, how regularly they're seeing things, all of that sort of stuff. And then I will just note that another kind of cool feature to it is that we've got a sync in place. So if you upload your pictures to that iNaturalist project, they should appear on our DWR Marsh Cam website as well. So if it's a particularly cool observation, you should be happy to know that you're sharing it with other folks, or other people can see it also, which is something I really like about it.
Megan, how can people follow along on all these different cams?
So my first recommendation to you would be to make sure that you follow our social media channels, because so many of our camera updates, they get shared on our social media pages, especially our Facebook page, but our Instagram page as well. And likewise, subscribing to our Notes from the Field blogs that get sent out to wildlife viewers on a monthly basis. That's a great way to keep up with those cameras. And whenever we have something like new or exciting, typically those Notes from the Field viewers are the first to learn about it. You know, the other thing that you can do, like for Falcon Cam in particular, if you're really, really interested in Falcon Cam, we actually have a way that you could subscribe to get our blog updates sent directly to your email. That's something that a lot of folks choose to do. You know, we didn't really talk about that blog too much, but I do an educational blog alongside the stream every year. So that's where you can get the information about when we're expecting eggs to hatch, you know, what's going on with the chicks, that all of that sort of stuff. So if you want to get that sent to your email, you can subscribe to that on the Falcon Cam website on DWR's page. And then, you know, speaking of DWR's page, we actually have kind of like a home base for each one of our cams, Falcon Cam, Elk Cam, Marsh Cam, and Shad Cam, that you can access very easily through the website. And the thing that's nice in particular about this is that it kind of gives you a little status update for each of the cams. So it tells you like if they're online or off for the season. So like the Marsh Cam is on 24/7. So that one should always be online, but you could look to see when Falcon Cam's coming back, when Shad Cam's coming back, and when Elk Cam is going to be turning back on for the season.
Megan, we didn't talk that much about Elk Cam, but can you at least say what the season is for Elk Cam?
So the elk cam that follows our elk herd, which is they're reintroduced here in Virginia. It follows them during the elk breeding season, otherwise known as the rut. So that you can expect to have on in the fall. Typically, we do it on around the end of August. That's a really, really cool one too, because that lets you see, all the different behaviors that are going on at that particular time in the year. So, the formation of these large kind of harems or family groups, and then males challenging another male to try to take his females. You can hear male elks bugling, which, if you've never heard that before, that is just like another thing that I have no words to describe the experience, but it's absolutely amazing. And you can see cows and calves and all that. So lots of fun stuff to be had in fall with elk cam as well.
Yeah, and there's going to be a future episode of this podcast dedicated just to the reintroduction of the elk herd in Southwest Virginia, which I'm also really excited about. I have a couple of questions that I ask all my guests before we finish up. So one of them is, what is one piece of gear you can't live without?
For me, it would have to be my camera. I am a big, I wouldn't say I'm a very good wildlife photographer, but I really enjoy wildlife photography. So I do make sure that I always have my camera with me.
You and me both. And I'll bet as a biologist, you probably can appreciate capturing animal behaviors on camera.
Just as like a little side note too, I'll tell you. So my background is actually really primarily with reptiles and amphibians, right? So like I spent a lot of time as a kid just like I always needed to touch stuff, right? Like I was one of those kids. Like I wanted to catch the frogs and hold it and all of that kind of stuff. But as you get older and especially like more trained, you learn like kind of the stress that that can put on animals. And I feel like photography is like a nice alternative to that, right? Like instead of catching things, I can get a photo of them.
It's just
And
a
it's just
different
like,
way of catching
yeah,
it. Yeah.
exactly.
Yeah, I
Yeah.
can appreciate that for sure. And what is your next big Virginia outdoor adventure?
Ooh, so I think the next big Virginia outdoor adventure that I have and that I'm furiously working on is back to my love of the tidal marshes. I've got a citizen science project that's focused on monitoring diamondback terrapins that's going to involve kayaking all of our tidal waterways in Virginia and having folks document terrapin sighting. So come May, I am going to be spending a lot of time on a kayak, and hopefully a lot of volunteers are going to be out there spending a lot of time on kayaks as well as we look for terrapins.
Okay, so my hand is in the air as a volunteer because
Okay.
I love diamondback terrapins. They're absolutely my favorite turtle. And I just recently, this past year, saw a few in the wild for the first time. And they're just so beautiful. Like the markings on their arms and their legs and their carapace and their neck. And they've got this really cool, like light colored patch on their snout. And you just see their little head sticking up from the water. And oh my gosh, like I could talk about terrapins all day. They are the neatest turtle.
Yes, me too. They're my favorite for sure, for sure. So maybe we just need to do a future episode. We can talk about terrapins in the
Hey, I'm
future.
down for that. Sounds good to me.
Thank
All right, Megan, thank you so much for being a guest on Virginia Outdoor Adventures.
you for having me. This was great. This was great. Thank you.
Adventure on. Links and resources from this episode are in the notes section of your listening app and on the website at virginiaoutdooradventures.com. If you enjoyed the show, please consider supporting me. The easiest and most impactful thing you can do is visit buymeacoffee.com/JessicaBowser, where you can buy me a virtual coffee or sign up for a membership. Members receive access to the full list of show notes, Virginia Outdoor Adventures vinyl stickers, and a shout out on the show. You can also support me by subscribing to the show on your listening app. Help spread the word by sharing the show or your favorite episode with friends or on social media. Last but not least, leave a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. I love hearing from my listeners. You can find me on Instagram and Facebook at Virginia Outdoor Adventures or on the website virginiaoutdooradventures.com. Thanks for listening. Until next time, adventure on.